rating of the position. And then the problem came after he'd been with us 6 years with an appointment in physics as an assistant professor. And was he going to be kept on? What about his tenure? What about his chances for promotion? Well, I could have told the physics department there were a good many members there who we could dispense with more readily than with Les Pauly as far as service to the campus was concerned. But when you're saddled with dead wood that has tenure, that's mixing your metaphors, isn't it?
Yeah.
What can you do about it except let it rot? Live with it. And they battled over that question for, I think, 2 years before Les finally got his recommendation for tenure in physics. But it took him a long time then to build the Center for Continuing Education back up into a healthy condition, because the destruction of the education department by John Toll created such a wave of resentment among secondary school teachers and elementary school teachers that they stayed away in droves.
Why do you think Johnny did that? Was he pressured to do that from Albany?
I don't think so. He never told me. But I want it began, I guess, while I was on my sabbatical. But I think it was probably pressure from Hofstra and Adelphi and the private universities on the island, which felt that if we became too interested in teacher training, we were cutting into their bread and butter, and they were suffering. But what it did to the teaching community was simply just a slap in the face to say, Stony Brook's not interested in you, or your kind of teaching, or your work. Go somewhere else. And what Albany did at the same time, that was not SUNY, that was the Board of Regents, I think. They changed the rules about accreditation, the requirements for getting a raise in salary and permanence in position by no longer requiring a master's degree, or no longer saying that a master's degree would count toward this. You could fulfill that obligation for additional education by taking a BOCES course or something like that, you see.
Watering down the quality.
What?
It's a watering down of the quality.
Yes, and you never can expect that out of the secondary school community by itself there can come the kind of professional retraining that is so necessary. It's got to be an interaction between the highly professional university and college community of scholars and the secondary and elementary school teachers. That was something that we learned profoundly in the BSCS, that if you left the writing of the new textbooks or the planning of the new experiments or anything like that to the teachers on the team, it wouldn't be any good.
The BSCS, what
Biological Sciences Curriculum
Study. Curriculum Study, yeah.
And it was the one big curriculum study of the early 60s that lasted.
Yeah.
Every other one, when they published their first books, went out of existence. Physics, chemistry.
Mathematics.
Mathematics, geology, all of them just quit. And so you had a one-shot elevation, and then it naturally flowed down the parabolic curve to the previous condition. We recognized in biology that this would have to be done over and over and over again, a continuing basis. And continuing education in the universities and colleges ought to be geared to that kind of a curriculum improvement.
The field was growing so fast.
Yes. And now to say, well, we'll set up BOCES as a thing, the schools can do all of this curriculum improvement on their own. It's like pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. It can't be done. And on the other hand, we found that if you left the job entirely to the scientists, they couldn't see what the teaching problems were. And they would think up something beautiful, ingenious, and satisfying maybe to graduate student, but totally unintelligible to a high school student because they weren't at that point. And so it was only with this often violent interaction between paired, teamed, secondary school and college university people that you had a fruitful outcome. And that was what I was hoping we might engender here. Well, it's good, but it's far from that. I think a big new task remains to be done.
Right.
Ready to turn it over?
I think we probably should, yes. I think we should. All right, now we're going.
Well, the most difficult administrative problems were certainly those revolving around chairman, who, as the university grew, were no longer really suitable for their posts. And many of these were among the early founders.
Right.
And
Lou Ferrin in anthropology.
Frank Erk, Martin Travis, and so on.
Right. Francis Bonner.
When then a group of the senior faculty of a department would come to me and say, well, he's a nice guy, and we all like him, but he just doesn't have the stature and the understanding of the problems that are arising to be a chairman for Department of National Recognition. We want a new chairman. And since these were good people, often good friends of mine, close friends of mine, it was one of the most delicate things that I ever had to do to convince them that it was not only in the best interests of their departments and of the university that they should step down, but it was in their own best interest too. And that was the line I usually took. It's in your own best interest to do this. Get rid of these administrative burdens and you'll find life will be quite different, more pleasant, than you can get some research done, you can get some teaching done that you haven't been in, more graduate students trained, and you will enjoy it. Well, I had that problem twice in biology, because biology was growing by leaps and bounds, and what had once been a single department became four departments and a whole division with eventually a provost over it and so on. That was later, but That first rebellion involved Frank Erk, and he was my first graduate student, and one of the people who tried hardest to get me here, I guess. And I had to just face him frankly and tell him that I thought he couldn't continue under the circumstances of the not just the restive condition of his department, but the resentment and the active opposition that had developed, and that in his own interest, and he really should step down and let them see if they could do better with a new person coming in from outside. Well, they didn't always get a new person coming in from outside. They got Raymond Jones to take it over, and he lasted about 2 years before the same thing happened to him that had happened to Frank. That the department was, or the departments by that time were up in arms, and so he was persuaded that to head the international educational activities of the university would be a good thing. I wonder who that is. Well, the German department gave us a lot of trouble. Andrew White, good scholar, but a very dictatorial Germanic kind of chairman, apparently, soon had a revolt on his hands. There wasn't anybody really to take his place. John Russell and Russell Brown, we just kind of farmed it around, but Andrew White had to be removed. Political science was very difficult. Martin Travis, everyone fond of Martin, done a very good job building up that department, but there again he had a revolt on his hands, and I just had to go to Martin and say, I know that you're very interested in this Institute of American Studies and need more time to put on that. And, the department is concerned about recruitment and administrative conditions, and we think it's better for you to step down. It would be better for you. And I think I've said this to you before. One of the things I'm proudest of in my whole administration is that I was able to work these things out so that I retained the warm personal relationship, friendship with these people. Yeah.
And David Trask in history, that was another one.
Really?
David Trask was appointed chairman of history with great expectations, and suddenly something began to go wrong, his relations with the other members of the department. And there it really didn't seem to be resolved until he left. But that was after my time. But he retired from the chairmanship anyway. And then there was the question of Chief of Libraries, Reuben Welch, from the very first, practically. He was very upset when it was suggested that there was too much dissatisfaction and trouble and he should step down, but he did, and eventually, and I think things have worked out very well for him.
Let's see, where was Roscoe Rouse in this picture?
Well, he came as Reuben's successor.
I see.
He came from Oklahoma State.
I think he went back there.
Oh, no, wait a minute. I'm sorry. There's one in between. It's John Smith who came from, was it?
John Smith came from Texas?
Yes, that's right. He came from Texas.
Yes.
Roscoe Rouse came to succeed Reuben Welch, and he stayed, what, about 2 or 3 years. That was after my time. He went back to Oklahoma State.
That's it.
John Smith came in. So, now you may have some questions in addition to ask me that I have.
All right, just a second.
As we look at the development of the three major sections of the liberal arts curriculum, sciences, social sciences, and humanities, in terms of the structures that relate to them, in which they are now housed, the mathematics, physics, graduate building, the graduate chemistry building, graduate biology building, the graduate social science building. There is one graduate building which is missing.
Right. It was in the plan, and we had approval for it, and then at the very last it was cut out because of the crunch in Albany. That was my understanding. Yes. That's after my time, but
yes,
it was due, I think, to get started about 1972 or something like that, the humanities building.
Yes, right. What can you say about the balance among those three in terms of facilities and the quality of the faculty?
Well, I don't think there's any necessary close relationship between facilities and quality of faculty. In the long run, it may have some effect if the relative status of the humanities, let us say, at Stony Brook is clearly inferior to that elsewhere in comparable institutions. But I always remember that Herbert Spencer Jennings, who was the great biologist before my time at the Johns Hopkins University, he and all the others had just essentially one great big room, which was subdivided into laboratories and cubicles, but it was essentially just one big room underneath the library in Gilman Hall. And his own personal quarters consisted of a small office and a corner of the larger lab in which he taught his protozoology and genetics. And great things came out of that laboratory and that group. Often, trying to overcome adversity in the shape of facilities has unexpected advantages. But that's not to say that I would want a segment of a university over which I had any control to suffer for inferiority in facilities to the other branches. I think it's a tragedy that we never got our humanities building. I think that the departments have done rather well in spite of that. I think that English and French and German have come along very well.
you didn't mention music and the fine arts, of course, because they did get their building.
They got their building, that's right.
But it's the humanities that didn't get the building.
I'm thinking of the function of interpersonal communication that is inhibited when philosophy is not in one building, religion is in another building,
philosophy.
In English is in another building, the languages are on different floors in the library. Well,
let me tell you one thing that always made a remarkable impression on me at Hopkins. In the biology building, Mergenthaler, which is now being converted into administrative quarters, because they have a brand new biology building, twice as large. This was a big building itself, and it housed the biology department and the biophysics department, which was in a wing. There are three main stories, a basement story and an attic story, I won't count those, but three main levels. And we noticed over the years that interfaculty communication was much, much better even between departments when they were on the same floor than it was vertically between members of the same department who were on different floors. And I'm not so sure how much day-to-day communication goes on between members of different language departments, or English in the language departments, or philosophy in all of these. Anyway, it would have to be fostered by, yes, facilities which are conducive to such exchange in the form of broad seminars, that sort of thing. Now at Hopkins we had what we call the History of Ideas Club, which grew out of the great interest of Arthur O. Lovejoy in the history of ideas. And it wasn't very well attended by scientists, although I was a very regular member and president of the club for a year or so, edited its commemorative volume. But it drew people from the medical school. It drew people in the history of medicine, that is. It was widely attended by people from history, the languages, classics, political science, social sciences, and I named them all. Anyway, a very wide representation. That was the way we got the interplay,
right,
with the History of Ideas Club.
Well, that leads me to another question, and that is...
Meeting once a week.
That is the faculty, as a community of scholars...
It often isn't a community of scholars, it's often a collection of hermits.
The situation at Stony Brook prior, let's say, to 71, there were people who looked back to the Oyster Bay days with a certain amount of nostalgia, despite mm-hmm. all of the fuss.
Well, of course, when an institution is quite small, you can have a lot of interchange between people in different fields.
And the problem is, how do you, assuming that is a good thing, how do you maintain it when an institution begins to grow and you have separate buildings and people who are research-minded and focused on their own bailiwick, sometimes to the exclusion of a wider context?
Well,
I've always been a person to advocate, emphasize the importance of these broader contacts. Yes. And I think that it's done most successfully by not by building so much as it is by academic structures, not structures in the sense of buildings, but academic frameworks, right, such as a History of Ideas Club or a Center for Continuing Education that has a course like Science and the Future of Man that brings a physicist and a biologist and a medical man and a psychologist all together to do some exchanging of ideas and some planning. Philosopher.
I'm not bringing this up as in any sense a criticism. I'm simply trying to get at the way things were,
yeah,
on the early campus. And
well, it stands to reason that in the very highly specialized fields that the academic disciplines have become, there isn't going to be very much joint teaching, even between persons who are actually working right in the same field. They feel a certain degree of jealousy and antagonism, competitiveness, rather than a desire to get together. But it's always been recognized in the departments the way you overcome that is by having seminars.
Yeah. Right.
Seminars which all members of the department can come to or are supposed to come to and exchange views and talk together. And I think the Center for Continuing Education should provide that kind of a seminar atmosphere for academicians in different schools of the
that would require a dean of a considerable stature and respect from among his colleagues, or a department chairman who has that as an interest,
mm-hmm,
keeping the members of his department alive, or a dean.
Exactly.
So that the quality of one's administration, one's academic administration, I don't refer to budgets particularly. Is a key factor. Well, that's
one thing.
I'm not particularly in favor, you see, of the provost's distinguished lectures, which are each one a thing of its kind. One distinguished person who comes in, gives a lecture, answers some questions from the audience, and that's it. It takes a lot of money, and it doesn't tie in with anything else. What you need really is something that is integrated better, and that is what we tried to do in that Science and Future of Man course, to bring in distinguished people, but in the framework of contributing to an ongoing discussion between faculty members and students of these great problems, mm-hmm, that transcend individual disciplines.
Right. Right. Let's change the scene. Can you say anything about the support of Stony Brook by the central office, the governor's office, the legislature, local representatives, with respect to equipment, library, humanities, buildings? What is your impression? Did you have direct dealings with Albany yourself?
only in the sense that I participated in the annual hearings on the budget. I would go to Albany when we had these hearings with the Bureau of the Budget. Mm-hmm. And I never met with any legislators, mm-hmm. or but we had meetings with the central administration officers to some extent, and these meetings with the...
In particular in the central administration?
Well, I remember Harry Porter very well indeed, and almost exclusively, I would say. The others, of course, Sam Gould, and but he was always remote.
Sam Gould?
And as far as I was concerned, he was remote. And Boyer was the same way. He was remote. He didn't seem to come close to a knowledge of the local problems and issues. There was a great deal of talk about the need in the rise of SUNY to excellence of having at least one graduate university center that would be absolutely outstanding. And they gave a lot of lip service to this, but in practice, it was share and share alike.
In other words, that was
and political factors dominated.
You had to fight against Albany, and you had to fight against Buffalo, mm-hmm. and poor Binghamton got what was left. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think on the whole we got reasonable support. It was easier in the 60s than it became in the 70s and 80s, but one thing that really hurt the support of the arts and sciences at Stony Brook was the very rapid growth of the budget of the health sciences. And this became so big a thing, so expensive, that it began to drain sources of supply. And I think there was some perhaps unconscious feeling on the part of the budgeters that you're getting a first-rate medical institution, you're just going to have to cut back a little bit on what you get. And that was why the humanities building was cut out.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think that's going to be a permanent situation? The need is still there, I think.
Yes, the need is still there, and I think that maybe the Health Sciences Center is approaching a plateau of expenditure, that the basic structure is there now. So there shouldn't be this tremendous outlays, only that the amounts needed to keep it going and growing moderately.
Right.
And so maybe better times for the arts and sciences and engineering will be coming along. Mm-hmm.
What can you say about the support which we have received and sought and received from the federal government? In terms of our reputation with the federal government?
I think it has been very adequately related to the growth in the capacities of Stony Brook as an institution. There's just no doubt about the fact that Stony Brook has received more federal monies than I think perhaps the other three graduate centers combined. As a research center, this is a great one, but it still is not first rate. And it's a matter of personnel rather than support money, I think. We get the really good people and can keep them, then, and as I see it, this has been one of the tragedies of the last 10 years, We've gotten very good people and we couldn't keep them because SUNY did not raise salary levels quickly enough to maintain a balance with the rest of the country. And it has never pursued the goal in more than lip service that Stony Brook as the star in the crown should receive more support in proportion than other parts of the system. If I were at Buffalo, I might complain about other things, but I would say that the financial support within the limits of state funds has been fair, but not addressed to the main objective of producing one center of excellence.
Okay. Our relations with the organizations of the discipline, the national organizations of the disciplines, American Physical Society,
AIBS,
AIBS,
Biological.
How, what can you say about that? Have we exerted leadership in some of them? I know we've exerted leadership in some of them.
Well, I would say that most of the members of the National Academy of Sciences on our faculty were members of the National Academy of Sciences before they came here. There have been very few elections of persons who were faculty members while here. And that isn't just a matter of being overlooked. It's quite true that if you are in an institution like Harvard or Cornell, your chances of getting into the academy are much greater than if you were in, let's say, the University of Missouri. But it takes more of individual distinction if you're not in a place where your work is known at first hand.
Yes.
But in general, I would say that we are not doing too badly. A good example is the election of Bob Sokol to the National Academy of Sciences this year. I can think of three or four more faculty members, I think, who ought to be elected to the National Academy of Sciences. There are of that stature. On the other hand, we had an absolutely first-rate man in Paul Lauterbur,
yes,
and we let him get away.
Yeah.
A probable Nobel Prize winner. And that's what makes you feel discouraged a bit.
In what sense did we let him get away? We didn't pay him enough? We didn't give him...
Didn't pay him enough. Didn't give him the facilities he needed to carry on his work.
Why not? No, wasn't there any ability to evaluate his work and him as a person?
No, I think he was highly appreciated here, both in his department and in the administration. I'm not criticizing, but I don't believe that Albany has felt that you should make extraordinary efforts to keep the really good people, the stars.
Another example was when Princeton raided us and took away the whole new Department of Cell Biology. It was a small department, just beginning, but excellent people. And there's no way in which the local administration has the power to act in such matters with sufficient promptitude to keep the people. And that's the problem, that you have to go through so many levels of approval in Albany. Maybe it's beginning to clear up. They recognize now that there must be more local autonomy and more promptness in acting on things like this, and more room for exceptions. But it's done great damage over the past 15 years, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay.
But the organizations themselves, I think, are not inimical, or they're quite aware that Stony Brook exists and that there are good people here. But
do we have I'm thinking in terms of the conferences that are held here that relate that are sponsored by different departments, disciplinary conferences. We have a limitation in terms of our facilities for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we are building that now.
Yes. Right. Well, that was, originally there was a place in the building plan for a Center for Continuing Education that would have housing for conferences, mm-hmm. of course, a conference center. That went out quite early. Pressure of other needs being greater.
Yeah.
But it's true, we don't have the kinds of conferences of world distinction that are held at Brookhaven or that are held at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, mm-hmm. to take two of our good neighbors.
Yes, right. We had one, the International Society of Crystallographers. We had that
mm-hmm.
back around
yeah.
63 or 64. Chemistry. What was your impression, and now let's go back of 71, of the quality of the students that we were getting at that time, or since while you were here?
While you were
Well, you have to remember that I did not teach undergraduates until after that time. Mm-hmm. My experience when I did teach undergraduates, 71 to 76, was that it's a pretty good lot. I wouldn't say they were as highly selected as Johns Hopkins gets, but then that's to be expected in a public institution. And I have high respect for the capacities of the students, that's for sure. They're a very, very sharp and intelligent lot. Sometimes maybe they let their temporary political or social enthusiasms run away with them. But that happens everywhere.
That's one of the characteristics
Berkeley
of you.
Too.
Anyway, huh? Berkeley too, yes. No. Yes. Right.
No, I
taught a couple of courses at Santa Cruz the year I was on sabbatical after having been here as an administrator for 6 years, and my general impression was that the Santa Cruz students, being a kind of self-selected group among the University of California student bodies, were rather, they came from a better social background than our students here on the average. I think the fact that so many of our students have come out of rather low social backgrounds in New York City.
First-generation college.
Yeah, it's reflected, and there's nothing wrong with their intelligence. It's just that they haven't had that opportunity in their early years.
Right. Right. Well, I think I've
covered your questions.
Very well, yeah. I think so. Thank you very much, Dr. Glass.
Well, it's been fun to talk with you. I can say that I've never been sorry for a minute that I made the transfer to Stony Brook when I did.
When you did.
I've...